You're listening to the We Lead Well podcast, where well-being matters. This episode is brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchat.com and the Teach Well Alliance. Enjoy the show. Welcome to the latest episode of the We Lead Well podcast. I have to say, I am so impressed that it really feels like summer. And the summer holidays are coming. I think we've got just 3 weeks until the holidays, which is very exciting. I'm off to Cornwall for a couple of weeks, so I'll be surfing, spending time on the beach, probably eating some cream teas. Can't wait for that. So it's a really nice time of year. And I hope that you're all enjoying it and managing to get outside and get some fresh air and get some sunshine on your face. This week, I'm joined by Peter Radford. Peter was an assistant head in a large comprehensive school, and he quit that job to become a consultant in wellbeing for schools and senior leaders. And he does consultancy work on how you can take care of yourself better. He's written a book, Love Teaching, Keep Teaching, an essential guide to improving wellbeing at all levels in schools. So Peter really knows what he's talking about when it comes to wellbeing. And he's had the experience, just like I have, of burnout. And one of the reasons I've asked Peter onto the show is to help you to understand that it's okay not to be okay sometimes, but that it's really important to recognise it in yourself and to understand how you need to take a step back and start to take care of yourself. Because from passion for a job often can come overwhelm. And because we love our jobs so much and we're so driven to do our jobs, often we can push ourselves to the point of burnout. And Peter is really candid when he tells his story. And I love his honesty and how he talks about his experiences and what happened to him and how he overcame those obstacles. And how he's come out of the other side and how he's now supporting schools to help make sure this doesn't happen to other senior leaders. Enjoy the interview. Welcome to the We Lead Well podcast, Peter Radford. It's really nice to have you on here. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. I mean, we met, I think, a while ago now when I was in the process of thinking about the podcast and thinking about setting up my own business. So it's really nice that I think I mentioned to you back then about getting you on the podcast. So it's really good to have got round to it. Can you start us off by introducing yourself to the listeners and telling us a little bit about your story? I know your story is a little bit similar to mine, but let the listeners know what happened to you.
Yeah, sure. It's been a journey in many ways. So I started my career in youth work, went into teaching, trained on the job via the GTP route, and went through the head of year role, and then assistant head of a large secondary school overseeing teaching and learning, and SMSC, student voice and careers education.
I'm sorry for laughing. I'm sorry. This is one of the issues that I've got with job descriptions for senior leaders. So apologies. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but it just made me laugh.
That's the thing, isn't it? The remit is constantly changing and expanding. And that was one of the issues, actually. I now have my own business, which is called Beyond This, and I speak in schools. I'm an RE teacher by trade, philosophy and ethics, and oversaw the PSHE as well. And I've always been passionate about getting young people ready for life. That's what I believe education is for. And I got frustrated because fundamentally I think our schools aren't doing that very well. And I was trying to do that over many years, particularly utilising the UNICEF Rights Respecting School Award, which is brilliant and led two schools to become rights respecting schools. But that sort of holistic approach to the child and the rights of the child as the basis of everything we do is what I was passionate about. So now what I do is I speak in schools and lead training for staff around some of those aspects of education and school that I think have ended up on the periphery of school life and on the periphery of our educational projects, rather than as I believe they should be at the core. So that's what I do now. But it was a journey to get there. which unfortunately involved a breakdown. So in 2016, I kind of came to the end of myself. Remember vividly that sort of sense of feeling like there were so many plates spinning, some of those plates starting to wobble, some of them crashing to the ground. Then my boss bringing in another five plates and saying, can you spin these as well? Trying my best to do that. And then feeling like I wasn't coping. And I remember vividly one moment where I was sat at my computer in a lunchtime, actually frantically trying to whittle down the to-do list, but finding it was growing as I was crossing things off, and just stared at my inbox for a moment on one occasion, felt that sense of utterly overwhelmed, and had almost a premonition, a moment where I could kind of see, I'd never experienced this before, but a moment where I felt like there was a moment not too far away where I would stare at that to-do list and literally be able to do none of it. Like it would be completely debilitating. And that scared me. I could see that that was not very far away. And I thought I didn't want to be, I'd known other teachers, great teachers who had gone off, had major breakdowns. And I thought, I don't want that to happen to me. So I took the next day off, and then took the day after that off. For the next couple of weeks was basically trying to do my job from home, which every teacher will know, that the notion of a sick day where you actually have to send in cover whilst sick for, at the beginning of the day, it takes you your morning sometimes before you can actually allow yourself to be sick. For the first 2 weeks, therefore, was trying to kind of keep the plate spinning from home. And then I went to my doctor, and he was shocked to find that that's what I'd been trying to do. And he said, no, you really need to stop. And it was at that point, really, that things imploded. I think I'd been, the adrenaline to some extent keeps us going, doesn't it? And I had a real low point one day when my wife came home with the Tesco shop. I got up to help her put the groceries into the cupboards, and had a panic attack. Just something as basic as putting the milk into the fridge was so totally overwhelming. I couldn't cope with it. And she kind of ordered me, go and lie down. You need to go and lie down. And that was, I felt like a personal failure in that, because I never thought that would be me. I thought, I should be able to do this. All of the voices in my head, the bully in my own head, saying you should be able to cope. And I think, with hindsight now, I can see that bully in my head was one of the core reasons why it got to that point. And I think we all potentially have a voice in our heads that pushes us and drives us beyond reasonable levels at some points, and that's part of the issue. But it was kind of out of that I recognized that voice. I had some counseling on a couple of occasions that really helped me identify some of the core beliefs that were driving me to the point of exhaustion. But I recognized very quickly that I needed to make some major changes to my life. And that's when I decided I wasn't going to go back into that job, and I started my own business, and that's sort of 4 or 5 years in. And then just last year released the book Love Teaching, Keep Teaching, which is really a guide to addressing this well-being issue at all levels of school. And that's sort of where I am at now.
I'm really interested in a couple of things that you say there, because when you describe the vision that you had of yourself sitting there completely immobile, that's the point I got to. I got to a point where I was sitting at the desk in my office completely unable to do anything, which was so unlike me. I'd always been really driven, worker, ambitious, and got to the point where I just thought, I can't do anything. I had a huge to-do list. Yeah. And I was just completely paralyzed. I just felt like I've got loads of things to do and I just couldn't do it. And that was the point that I reached.
It's that feeling of almost being in sinking sand, like the more you try and get out of it, the deeper that you're sinking in. And that, I suppose it's a loss of hope. And I think more and more, I think this hope issue is something I'm speaking about more and more, because I think, especially given the last year we've had and how many students are responding to what's going on in the world at the moment, that loss of hope is critical for our mental health and well-being. When, if ever we get to the feeling like we can't see that things can get better, that's a potentially a decisive point where we start really going downhill fast. You know, that what's the point? Everything I do seems to make no difference. Is a very scary place to be in. And when you feel like I'm literally doing everything I know to do, and still it's getting worse. With hindsight now, I can see actually, and this is something I talk about in the book as well, is that self-awareness, because with hindsight, I can say I was having a panic attack on a daily basis, but I didn't know that that's what it was.
Yeah.
I had no awareness of my own mental health, no awareness of my own emotional well-being and the different facets and ingredients that make up, our emotional well-being, and was just sort of head down, plow through, try and get, to half term. And that's something teachers will resonate with, isn't it? It's that constant countdown timer in your head of four more days till the weekend, three more days till the weekend, 4 weeks till half term, just and feeling like I was counting my life away. surely that's not what it should be about. I mean, and I've sat in staff rooms and heard teachers literally counting only 15 more years to retirement, and they're already counting with 50 and wishing away the next 15 years. And I just think this is awful. Teaching is a phenomenal job. It's brilliant. I think it's the best job in the world. To be counting down like that seems like a tragedy, and we've got to do something about it.
And that's the thing, isn't it? And there are a few things that have come up for me in what you've said there. The first one is the idea of not understanding when you're going from pressure to stress and when the stress is getting too much for you, because I'm doing some accreditation to become a consultant in something called Resilient Leaders Elements. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that talks about is resilient decision making, but you have to understand your own sort of emotional and your ability to deal with stress. So understanding where you are on a continuum from being totally calm to being, it being absolutely chaotic, and being able to recognize in yourself, and you talk about awareness, and that's one of the elements of the work that I've been doing, is that idea of understanding yourself better so that you know when you reach that point of and what you can do to relieve the pressure as well. How do you get yourself back on an even keel? Now, I don't think I would have always said I was really resilient, but I probably didn't have the awareness that went with it to know that actually you have to be in balance in all the different areas of your life. And when one starts to become too difficult, it was really, like you were saying, exactly, I identified that, the spinning plates, and you feel like they start smashing to the ground. And there was something you mentioned, you talked about overwhelm, and I think it's an unfortunate side effect of the job of a teacher, because there's always too much work to do and not enough time, because essentially you're almost doing two jobs, aren't you? You're delivering in the classroom to the children, but you're planning, preparing and marking that as well, and that probably could take you all your time, couldn't it, aside from the teaching. But I think what goes is a passion, and I think for me that was probably something I should have picked up on. I always loved being in the classroom, and I loved working with staff, and that light went out for me, and I don't know when it went, so that I wasn't particularly enjoying my teaching, I wasn't enjoying the job. And I think it was interesting what you were saying about that with like teaching. Is it that losing of passion that makes you go, I've only got 15 years left? And then you just end up putting up with it, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's a really important realization to come to, that the job of teaching is impossible. And when we accept that there are so many facets to this job, so many aspects, that to do everyone perfectly, or to an outstanding, in inverted commas, level, is literally impossible and unsustainable. But because we use those words a lot in education, and we use these bars, we set these bars up that are human made, that they're made up, whether it's grade boundaries, they're made up, they move every year. Ofsted's gradings, they change the framework every few years. So all of these bars, all of these mechanisms are made up, but in our heads, we see them as sort of absolute standards that we must reach. And I think this was a key factor for me, because I have some perfectionist tendencies, I'm always looking at what I've not yet achieved, what I've not yet done, and I should have done that, or I could have done that, or if I just work a bit faster, a little bit harder, a little bit more efficiently, then maybe I'll get to where I should be. And of course, as human beings as well, we all have that innate tendency to compare ourselves to others. So, you know, within the staff room, within the conversations, we're picking up on, you know, oh, you've already done your reports, have you? Or you've already kind of got all of that marking done. And you seem to be coping really well. And your desk seems to be really neat and tidy. And my, so, we're unconsciously absorbing these sort of comparisons and often just living with this sense that I'm constantly falling short. And this was something I went through and really had to unpick with my counsellor over time, because I found I was still doing it, even outside of the classroom environment. I would be constantly making a to-do list that was far bigger than what I could achieve in a day, and then get to the end of the day always feeling like I failed. And that, you see, over time, achievement is one of the kind of a core psychological needs that we all have, that need to feel like we're achieving. And when we're feeling like we're constantly falling short, that chips away at our sense of well-being. I'm constantly failing. And my counselor gave me a little insight, a little quote that I literally live by now. And it's so simple, but it's been revolutionary to me. He said, as a kid, he used to help his granddad to dig his allotment. And his granddad used to say to him that when you're digging an allotment, always face what you've already dug. Because of course, there's two approaches to digging. You can dig and see all of that I still need to dig. If I literally turn around my perspective, I'm facing what I've already dug. I can actually, I've not done that yet, but look what I have actually achieved something today. And I think the problem is in our educational context, in our classrooms, is we're constantly focusing on what hasn't yet been done, or what we could have done, or what we could have done differently, or how it could have been better. And we're never actually recognizing that I made a difference today. I helped a student today. I made somebody's day today. I helped my students grow today. And that statement there, I think, is the critical one. Did I help my students grow today? That is your only responsibility as a teacher. And so that mindset shift for me has been revolutionary. So I now keep a record of achievements on a daily, weekly basis, so that I can see what I have done instead of constantly beating myself up because of what I haven't yet done. And that mindset shift, I think is really important, but the converse mindset of always putting pressure on ourselves, I think, is baked into the way that we're running our schools and the way that we're running our education system.
And that's interesting, because it brings me back to something I was going to ask you about probably about 15 minutes ago now. What were the core beliefs that would drive that drove you to the point of exhaustion? Because you mentioned that you worked on those with your counsellor, didn't you? What were they?
Yeah, so that feeling of it never being good enough, I would actually put down to a conservative Christian upbringing. That has quite a nasty word for falling short. So the word sin in Christianity is kind of defined as falling short of God's best. Now, without realizing it, that notion was really baked into my consciousness. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, if you've not achieved perfection, well, that's sin. But sin is quite a negative word to give falling short of perfection. And yet that was definitely sort of core in my consciousness. So I had this sense as well. And again, within Christianity, there's that sort of value of sacrifice and suffering as being redemptive. And so this idea of suffering in order to have worth, or to make a change, or to be worthy, that was baked into my consciousness as well. So looking back, I can see that unless I got to the end of a day and could really feel like I was exhausted, I hadn't suffered enough in order to legitimate my share of the oxygen that I had breathed that day. And when you unpack it like that, that sounds quite extreme. I wasn't conscious of that, but it was with hindsight that I could see, I felt like I needed to suffer and have really kind of overworked to the point of exhaustion in order to feel that my contribution was valuable. So I mean, that I think is a very unhealthy approach to work. It's an unhealthy approach to value. But I think it's not just there as a result of kind of some Christian thinking or dogma. I see it in our staff rooms, and as we were saying, before we started recording, that tendency to feel like if I haven't been marking until 10 o'clock I've been working till midnight last night, we get some sort of sense of value and worth from how busy, how much we've suffered. And I think that's baked into a lot of people's consciousness, that my value is a derivative of my busyness or my suffering or my effort, rather than the more positive affirmation that I am valuable, you are valuable simply because you are a human being. Your validity and your value does not derive from how much you've sweated or how much you've suffered. You have value simply because of who you are and the contribution that you can give. And that's a mind shift. Do you know what I mean?
And that is a huge mind shift, because like you're saying, it's baked into the mentality of teachers and school leaders. And I think it's linked to the value that most of us hold of service, that we are there to serve others. And in that, like you're saying, these two ideas of suffering and sacrifice are so key. And all of the things that you've mentioned, that I was up till this time doing that, it's about look how much I've sacrificed myself. It's like proving yourself that you're in service to others. Like my feeling about that, about being in service to others, is being a role model and showing how you can work in a different way so that you can also be kind to yourself, so that you can serve people better. And I read your article that you'd written about leadership and about how you can lead in a different way. And it's linked, isn't it, to sort of that idea of servant leadership being about sacrificing yourself, sacrificing your time, working all of the hours that God sends. A little bit like I said about, you know, people looking at me incredulously around the SLT table when I said I was, you know, I had to have lunch every day. Otherwise I couldn't work as effectively in the afternoon. So can you tell the listeners, because I think it's really, really interesting, about the article that you wrote about that, sort of the ideas of leadership, and that we don't necessarily have to believe those?
Yeah. It just strikes me on the back of what you just said then, again, how we measure our worth, and that sense of feeling like you're saying something out of the ordinary by suggesting that you needed to have lunch. It was once flagged up to me by my head teacher that he did not receive as many emails from me on the weekend as other members of SLT. And so seemingly, you know, the time that my emails were timestamped was being used as a measure of my worth or my value or my contribution or my effort or whatever. And I was incredulous at that, but I also recognized that to some extent I've been complicit in that, because I remember, you know, when those kind of conversations are going on in the staff room where people are talking about how much of the weekend they spent marking or working or whatever. And I had long since made a decision that I would not work on the weekend. That was a partial factor, I think, because I would work at such a relentless rate during the week in order to keep that weekend free. But I felt, the key thing is that I felt embarrassed to ever say that. So I didn't tell people that I didn't work on the weekend, because especially as someone on SLT, I felt like they would think less of me. They would think that was unacceptable, that I should be,
enjoying your weekend.
Or protecting that time for my family. So there's that sort of complicity. But where the article comes in is a lot to do with the difference between controlling and enabling leadership. And often, there's an approach to leadership that is baked into our system, a very hierarchical top-down leadership, which is based on distrust. So an assumption that if we leave people alone to teach, they will slack off. If we let them do it in their own way, they will cut corners. They will not, you know, achieve the outcomes that we want to hold them accountable for. So therefore, we've got these accountability structures in place. We've got these monitoring and quality assurance processes in place in order to ostensibly make sure that teachers perform to the standard that we expect of them. In actual fact, I think most of those measures, if not all of those measures, are actually counterproductive. They create performance anxiety, and they lead to a very controlling approach to leadership. So you do what I want you to do in the way that I want you to do it, and we have this sort of a very narrowing approach to the final outcome that actually limits people's productivity rather than unleashing their potential to innovate and do things in new and different ways, rather than giving them the freedom to own what they do. They're box ticking, they're making sure out of fear that I've met the standards, that I've got X percentage up to their target grade, that I've marked X number of books, and it may not, so long as I can evidence that it looks like I've engaged with these books because there's some red pen on there somewhere. It basically leads to a race to the bottom. We're box ticking and we're trying to do the bare minimum because of a fear culture that is pushed down from the top. And what I'm arguing for as being far more effective is actually to change that notion of management and leadership from one that's controlling and monitoring to one that's coaching and supporting, which is a totally different way to see leadership. The one that's enabling, that allows people to innovate, to invent, to be creative, to come up, you know, the problem from a whole different ways and means and perspectives. And there's potential there for changing the way we do school, but it's fundamentally based upon trust. Do you believe, you know, do you trust people to do their best, or do you expect them to do their worst? And a lot of people come at, you know, have an assumption about human nature that people are innately lazy, are innately selfish, and are innately trying to cut corners. I don't think that's true. I don't think anybody turns up to work to do a rubbish job. I don't think anybody gets out of bed, any teacher gets out and thinks, I want to be a crap teacher today. I fundamentally think people want to do well. So the role of leadership is to enable them to make their best contribution.
Before we hear more from Peter, I just want to tell you a little bit about our partner, Head Teacher Chat. Head Teacher Chat discusses lots of topics, from how to support pupils with learning, how to support parents, and the many issues that come with leading a school. The aim of Head Teacher Chat is to support head teachers and school leaders who are in a challenging and often lonely role. They do this by offering lots of information for schools to tap into. For example, they have lots of fantastic education companies on their database for leaders to discover, as well as leadership templates to download. They've written product reviews for leaders who are looking for products for their school. And this year, they've even launched the very first school leader planner, especially designed to help leaders to be productive and organised. If you'd like to hear more about Head Teacher Chat, you can find them on their website at www.headteacherchat.com. Head Teacher Chat. It's what head teachers are talking about. Now let's get back to the interview.
When we put in place structures that generate fear, what we actually achieve is the opposite of what we're trying to achieve. We end up making people feel anxious, making people less creative as they kind of rush for the accepted, tried and tested ways to do what they do, rather than thinking, I saw this great thing on the weekend, or I read this, I want to try my set one English lesson differently today. So I think there's huge potential if we would take trust seriously and build that trust into our school systems. I would argue that our school systems at the moment are based on distrust of teachers and professionals, and that in itself undermines our well-being on a day-to-day basis because we feel devalued, untrusted, and that, you know, that doesn't feel good.
It's really interesting that you talk about that idea of us being intrinsically bad and lazy, greedy, whatever it is, you know, choose your adjective and insert here. And that people, that's one of the reasons, I think, for that going over the top with things, is trying to prove yourself almost. You know, you can have a trust in leadership, but often people are trying to prove that they're not lazy, that they're not whatever it is, aren't they? It's something that's part of us. Like, oh, because we project our thoughts onto other people, if I don't behave in that way, or if I don't do that, then that person is going to think I am lazy, not very good at what I'm doing, or whatever it might be. So how do you, so it's not only about trust, is it? It's about reassurance, isn't it, as well? How do you create that sense of, like, we trust you and you are doing a good job?
We all need to be a lot more vocal in acknowledging people's contribution. A really interesting study was done by a guy called Dan Ariely at Duke University. He's a psychologist there. And he had test subjects complete very, very mundane, very basic tasks. And they were given $3 for each task, just a side of A4 where they had to kind of complete some tasks. $3 each time. Then the next time they did it, $2.40. The next time, $2. The next time, $1.60. So they wanted to see how long would these people continue doing the same fairly basic mundane job for less and less remuneration. But they had three different variables. So the first group would complete the mundane task, bring it to the overseer. The overseer would look at it and then put it in a pile on his desk. The second group would bring their work to the overseer, and the overseer would not look at it. They just put it directly into a pile on the desk. The third group, the people would bring their work to the overseer. The overseer would put it directly into a shredder. Now, they wanted to see what, they're all being paid exactly the same amount of money for doing exactly the same thing. What impact did that have on their motivation? Well, the first group and the third group, you would expect differences. The first group continued with the task far longer than the people whose work was put directly into a shredder. The interesting thing is group two in the middle. So group two, their work was not looked at. It was just put in a pile on a desk. And the interesting thing is that the impact or the results for group two were identical to group three. In other words, the impact of not acknowledging work has the same impact on our motivation and cycle and kind of psychological response as if that work was deliberately destroyed in front of you. Now the thing is, in education, we do a huge amount every day. We're in it for the kids. We're in it because we believe in it. We're not looking for, you know, we're not in this for the money. We didn't go into this, you know, to get rich. We believe in what we do, but we don't take seriously the utterly debilitating effect it has when our work is not acknowledged. Not necessarily all big, you know, song and dance, here's a bottle of wine, just acknowledged. And that's partly because we're all caught up in this busyness machine that we've almost, we've believed that we're too busy to even make eye contact with another teacher as we pass them in the corridor. Sorry, too busy. Or just to stop and have that chat and just say, how are you? You know, did you have a good weekend? That acknowledges, I mean, in transactional analysis, Eric Byrne calls those strokes. Every time that you interact with somebody, it's a stroke, either a positive stroke or a negative stroke. And if you pass someone and they don't even make eye contact with you, that's a negative stroke. If they do just raise their eyebrows at you, that's a positive stroke. And over the course of every day, we build up a cumulative total of negative or positive strokes. And if that cumulative total is much bigger on the negative side than the positive side, then that leaves us, perhaps without even consciously being aware of it, debilitated, feeling low, feeling devalued, feeling like I don't matter, my you know, contribution isn't acknowledged, and so on. We all have the potential to change that if we take seriously the need that we all have for acknowledgement. And particularly those in leadership, because those in leadership roles, the impact of their strokes is magnified, it's multiplied. A stroke, an acknowledgement from someone who's a leader or line manager has a multiplied impact on the person. And just taking the time to acknowledge, really appreciate your work on that, really appreciate that, you know, that's a really tricky class and, you know, you've done well. Just those little things make a massive impact. Maya Angelou said something, which one of my favorite quotes. She says, people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And that, I think, is the critical challenge. We all, you know, we can look at the whole education system and think, what can I do? You know, yeah, you know, Gavin Williamson, what's next? And we take that sort of passive, let's see what the next change is, let's see what Ofsted says next, and that sort of passive, powerless approach, when in actual fact, we all have power every single day with every single interaction we have to make people feel good or not. And that's where culture can change.
It's really interesting. When you talk about, you know, keeping a record of your achievements or writing something down, asking yourself the question at the end of the day, how have I made people feel today? Yeah. Could really make a big difference, couldn't it, into how you deal with people. I agree with you, right? People want to be seen, don't they? We're all... One of the things that makes me feel really sad is that we talk about childhood and then we say, oh, we're grown up now. You know, we're not children anymore. Yeah. But everybody has a child inside them. We still have those needs for recognition. You know, I suppose it's a bit like attachment theory, isn't it? We want to feel that we're loved by someone. And in work, that translates to we want to feel valued in that place. And how it's about how you go about showing your staff your value, just by saying thank you. No, you know, not even like that was a really good piece of work, but thank you for doing that. Just, yeah. You know, and as a member of a senior leadership team, getting out around, like, you can put cakes in the staff room, but it's not individual thanks, is it? It's not actually that interaction between two people where you say thanks so much for doing that for me. Yeah. You know, it's made a difference to me because it meant I could do something else.
It costs nothing. That's the thing. But it is a decision, and it's something that needs to be done consciously, because we'll all be guilty of those times of just thinking, I'm too busy. And ironically, at one point in one of the schools I worked for, there was a mandate that came from the top. And it was in an effort. It was well intended. It was in an effort to try and cut down on the amount of emails that everybody's got. But this edict, therefore, came down from SLT saying that you should not send an email saying thank you, because that's an unnecessary additional email. So if basically, you know, you've asked a question, the question has been answered, do not reply again to say thank you. And I mean, the short-sightedness of that is, you know, is staggering. But it's those thank yous that actually give us the impetus and the energy to keep doing what we do every day.
Yeah, I got an email just at the weekend about the group coaching program that I'm doing with the Multi Academy Trust, that just said the feedback's been really positive so far and it's already making a difference. And that made me feel reassured that the work that I'm doing is having an impact. And that's the important thing, isn't it? It's making someone feel like the work that they're doing is worthwhile and making a difference. And I wonder how many times as an SLT, you know, you would sit down and say, what impact is our behaviour and the way we're working, what impact is that having on the staff in this school? And being really honest about it and not trying to say, oh, it's having a great impact. I think the staff are, you know, the staff are really happy. And if that's not actually the case. But I think the thing as well is, we as senior leaders got to a point where we became overworked and we got to burnout. So I think what we need to do is change cultures in senior leadership as well. Mm-hmm. So how do you think we can go about doing that?
Absolutely. I mean, we've got to model change. And I know leaders who will be proactive about encouraging their teams. You know, you go home now, leave that, don't worry about that marking. But they're not modeling it themselves. And there's that sense as well of, I as a leader can't be seen to be leaving school at 4 o'clock. Why not? Because you're a leader. And again, we've all bought into this. The leader should be working the hardest and the longest hours. I don't know, potentially to justify the increased pay that we have. And again, there's a skew with thinking there in terms of measuring worth, again, and financial remuneration, therefore, in terms of time and sweat, rather than in terms of outcomes or responsibility, which is a totally different way of looking at it. So we've got to model sustainable living. But again, it's that penny that you've already alluded to needs to drop. That I am going to have a better, more sustainable, multiplied impact, both on the staff that I lead and on the students that we're responsible for, if I am well, if I am thinking clearly, if I give myself the thinking time and the breathing time to read, to think innovatively, to consider other viewpoints, to talk, to socialize, to be healthy, to exercise. All of these things are going to mean that I'm going to be a better teacher, a better leader, a more effective leader. So that penny needs to drop, that it is in the interests of other people for me to look after myself. It's not selfish for me to look after myself. So we need to take it seriously and model it at the senior level. And that's going to take some self-reflection, because sometimes as well, we're using our own busyness actually to deflect from the other things that are going on in our lives. So it's very easy to think, well, I've got a dysfunctional marriage going on over here. That's painful. That's maybe, that's something that I need to address, but I don't know how to address it. Much easier to tell myself I haven't got time to address it because I've got to work. So we're using our busyness to excuse ourselves from engaging or addressing the marriage, or addressing my relationship with my kids, or addressing my health. I'm too busy. So that self-reflection, and I would encourage leadership teams, first and foremost, if you're going to address mental health in your school, and if you're going to address adolescent mental health, which is obviously at epidemic levels, we need to look after our kids far better. But as long as we're not modeling it, as long as we're not living it, tagging on, you know, another tutorial or two, or doing some assemblies on mental health is never going to cut it. We've got to take seriously that the whole school community needs to shift, and that needs some brave, bold leadership at the top for leaders to self-reflect, be honest with themselves, be honest with each other, get that stuff out on the table, you know, of acknowledging, look, when did you last sit and actually eat lunch and not work whilst eating lunch? We know that skipping lunch, you know, is one of the precursors of burnout. We know that. Let's ask ourselves some of those tough questions. Let's have that sort of 360 on ourselves as leadership teams, and say, what, you know, what can we model, what can we change in order to move forward in a more holistic, positive, sustainable way, that then we can with legitimacy recommend change and lead change with those in our school communities.
I think one of the things that that is really important that you talk about there is the idea of self-awareness and awareness of others as well, and an awareness of your environment, which is really important. But that idea of self-reflection and reflecting on yourself, we had a guest speaker who came to speak to the women leaders group that I'm running at the moment. And it was Helen Kelly. She's been on the show previously. And she talked about how we are self-saboteurs as leaders because of a lot of the things that we do. So, for example, we are very driven often as leaders. We love our job. We're people pleasers. So we're constantly trying, you know, we think in a way, a lot of those things as well, they come from good places. They come from, you know, you're driven because you want to achieve and you want to get more for the children or for your staff or whatever it is. But I think your point about self-reflection and understanding yourself better and being able to think about how you can change the way you are. And that's where coaching, I think, can be very empowering and impactful.
Absolutely.
Because it's very easy for a leader. I think I was saying before we started recording about someone in my other women leaders group who said, I've got all this work to do, so I have to work in the evenings or I have to work at weekends. And I said, right, I'm going to stop you there and say, you know, she was saying, I can't. And I said, you can. You just have to work out how you can do it. Because my experience of being like that and being driven and working, being in work at 7 and not leaving till 6 and had to stop because of my circumstances once I separated. So it is possible to work in a different way, but sometimes we don't do that until something significant happens.
Absolutely. So starting with that recognition that I am responsible for my own life and I am responsible for my own choices. And as human beings, we all like to blame. It makes us feel better. It helps us legitimate and justify the situations that we're in. But fundamentally, change has to start with me. I can't change other people. I can't change the government. I can't change the education system, but I can change me. So I am responsible. That has to be the starting point. And if I'm responsible, then I've got to acknowledge that my life at the moment is the product of my choices. If I don't like my life at the moment, then I can change it because it is the product of my choices, my thoughts and my decisions. And that's a kind of an eye-opening, empowering position to be at. You know, there's something powerful about somebody facing their own future front on and acknowledging I am responsible. So what am I going to do to bring about the life that I want to live? Because as long as we're blaming, as long as we're pointing the finger, we're basically admitting powerlessness. We're accepting there's nothing I can do because, you know, until Gavin Williamson does, or until, you know, the Conservative government changes, or until Ofsted, you know, brings in a different framework, there's nothing I can do. That you're accepting an utterly futile position of powerlessness, when in actual fact, we can all make changes on a daily basis in the choices, the decisions that we make to operate differently. And one very simple change, as an example that I made, that has revolutionized my life, is to not have one list. That was killing me. It's not a list, it's a noose. Not one list. So I now have a minimum of 3 lists. I have a today list, which is the urgent things and only the things that must be done today. Then I have a this week list. And then I have an other list that things that need doing, that need to give me some time to. But for those all to be on one list, which is what they were, the list never ever looked like it was ever getting any shorter. It wasn't getting any shorter. And that was I wasn't aware of that. But with hindsight, I can see that was playing a part in me feeling constantly like I'm treading water. And I'm sinking. So that's an example of a very small change that we can make, which changes our approach to life, our approach to work, and has a psychological impact on the way we're feeling at the end of the day.
And giving yourself permission not to do things as well. I think sometimes you can cross things off those lists and think, do you know what? I'm not going to do that. I won't have time. I'm not going to do it. And giving yourself permission and making that okay. It's been really great to talk to you, Peter. Thank you so much. I think there's loads to take from this show. And I said I wanted to talk about, to reassure the listeners that if they did want to go and do something else, there is life beyond teaching. And I think we are both evidence of that, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Although I don't see what I'm doing now as not teaching, but it's teaching in a different way. And I think that's one of the things that I would say, that some people, I think, feel like, well, look, I am a teacher. This is who I am. And I believe in this. And therefore leaving feels like a betrayal of what I do and what I am. And I think that's not necessarily the case. You know, if you fundamentally believe you are a teacher, just give yourself permission to see different ways to make that educational contribution that is all part of the whole. We need to just broaden our mindset and our expectations and our definitions sometimes, to recognize that I can make my best contribution in a myriad of different ways. And sometimes, it's taking a break from one way. I'm actually at the moment looking for a one day a week job because I want to get back into the classroom, because I miss students in the classroom and that relationship that you get and the rapport that you have with students over time. But it's I'm looking at a more balanced approach, and I'll be going back into the classroom with a totally different mindset in the way that I approach things. But yes, there's life after school, but teaching, I think, is something that we will do to, you know, till the day we die.
It's a vocation, isn't it? Yeah. And I think what you've just said there is that idea of sometimes you can give yourself a break, do something different for a couple of years and go back to it. You know, never say never is my, I think, my mantra. Never say never. I don't know what the future holds, but I'm enjoying doing this for now. And like you say, having an impact on what goes on in classrooms. I'm just not in the classroom, but I know I'm having an impact on it from the work that I do with leaders and teachers. Yeah. So if people want to get in touch with you, if they want to find out more about the work that you're doing, read your blogs or your book, where can they find you?
Beyondthis.co.uk is my website. My book is called Love Teaching, Keep Teaching. That's available on Amazon. My Twitter handle is at @PRadfordSpeaker. Do follow me and have a look at some of those things and get in touch if I can support in any way.
Thank you so much for joining us, Peter. Have a great day.
Thanks very much.
I want to say a big thank you to Peter for coming on and sharing his experiences with us, and for talking so honestly with us about his struggle. And I think it's a struggle that we all recognise in teaching, and it's so important to understand. Peter said teaching is impossible, and he's absolutely right. It is an impossible job. And if we acknowledge that teaching is impossible, we can maybe start to cut ourselves some slack for not always being as perfect as we want to be, and not feeling that overwhelm that we're just not doing the job quite to the standard that we would like to do it. I thought a really good idea that Peter shared with us was the idea of keeping a record of your achievements, and let that give you some sustenance in times where you're finding things difficult. For example, I used to keep all the cards that I'd been given by staff and pupils on my wall, and I wasn't doing it to show off. I was doing it for myself, so that I could just galvanise myself in moments of, if I was having a doubt or I was, you know, worried about something that was going on, I could look at the cards and it would just give me that lift, and it would help me to see that I have been successful, and it would sometimes keep the imposter at bay. So thanks to Peter. So if you enjoy the show, join our Facebook community, the We Lead Well Facebook community. I'd love to see you join us in that group. And I am taking applications now for my September cohort of the Women Lead Well group coaching program. So if you're interested in that, you can express your interest on Facebook, or you can visit the website www.transformeducationcoaching.com. It would be brilliant if you would like to apply for that. That's all we've got time for this week. So go out there, enjoy the summer, take care of yourself, take care of your staff, and lead well. This episode of the We Lead Well podcast was brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchats.com, and the Teach Well Alliance.